content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Greg Cockcroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is The Atlantic. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from The Atlantic magazine. First today, an ode to the left hand. Get in touch with your non-dominant side. By James Parker. I raised the drumstick, brought it down, and a dream world opened beneath me. A dream world to be clear of incompetence. A dream world of crapness and debility. A slump in tempo, an abyss. I was sitting at my practice drum kit, attempting one of the signature moves of the late John Bonzo Bonham of Led Zeppelin. Triplets with a left-hand lead. Done properly with the correct dosage of taste and power in each stroke, left-handed triplets will conjure an extraordinary kind of jazzy thunder. Done improperly, they sound like a wardrobe falling downstairs. When I lead with my right hand, my triplets are okay. Not Bonham-esque, not Bonzoid, but okay. But when I switch to the left, being human, reader, you know exactly what I'm talking about, righty or lefty. You know that if you lead with your non-dominant hand, whether you're brushing your teeth or dismantling an unexploded bomb, the cliches of maladroitness will swarm you. The fists of ham, the fingers of butter, the multiplicity of thumbs. Why this built-in asymmetry? This out-of-whack distribution of motor skills, the biology of handedness is complex, but the psychology, it seems to me, is pretty straightforward. It goes like this. Inside your nervous system lives a shadow person, a shadow you, shy and clumsy, dislocated, light-fearing, not nearly as good at things as you are, an underachiever who would very much like to be left alone. And you get in touch with this person immediately and directly by using your weaker hand. Work the left, they say the sports coaches. Learn how to catch a ball, throw a punch, make a shot with your weaker hand. Shouldn't the life coaches say it too? By summoning your gauche self, the muzzy and foot-dragging character who rises and sleeps with you, you're doubling your capacities. Treat this character with stern kindness, with a reproving warmth. Insist on discipline. Marvel humbly at the slowness of the progress. And if you, which is to say I, can eventually pull off the sweet bonzoid clatter of a clean left-handed triplet, then maybe, who knows, never say die, I can one day tackle the unfinished novel currently jutting out of my psyche like a lump of the Acropolis. They lurk on the shadow side, these possibilities. In the murk of the as-yet untrained, in the cunning of the weaker hand. Next, the China model is dead. The nation's problems run so deep and necessary repairs would be so costly that the time for a turnaround may have already passed. By Michael Schumann. China's jobless college graduates have become an embarrassment to Chinese leader Xi Jinping. The unemployment rate among the country's youth has reached an all-time high, putting the country's severe economic troubles on display at home and abroad. In August, Xi's administration decided to act. Its Statistics Bureau stopped releasing the data. But Xi can't hide China's economic woes or hide from them. The problems are not just a post-pandemic malaise or some soon-to-be-forgotten detour in China's march to superpower stature. The vaunted China model, the mix of liberalization and state control that generated the country's hypersonic growth, has entered its death throes. The news should not come as a surprise. Economists and even Chinese policymakers have warned for years that the China model was fundamentally flawed and would inevitably break down. But Z was too consumed with shoring up his own power to undertake the necessary reforms to fix it. Now the problems run so deep, and the repairs would be so costly, that the time for a turnaround may have passed. Contrary to the assumptions of many commentators in recent years, China may never overtake the United States as the world's dominant economy if current trends continue. In fact, it's already falling behind. A downward trajectory in China does not necessarily ensure the future of American global power, however. China may turn out to be a less formidable competitor than once imagined, and offer a less attractive model of development for the rest of the world. But economic failure could also heighten Xi's determination to overcome American dominance, if not by becoming richer, then through other, possibly more destabilizing means. The demise of the China model is in many ways a function of its tremendous success. When China's free market reforms were just getting underway in 1980, the country was poorer per capita than Ghana or Pakistan. Today, China has an $18 trillion economy capable of devising 5G telecom networks and electric vehicles. The motor of the China model is investment, and lots of it, into factories, highways, airports, shopping malls, apartment towers, you name it. China was destitute at the outset of its reforms, and much of the new infrastructure was necessary. Better transport systems helped to boost economic efficiency. New housing sheltered families migrating from farms to cities in search of opportunity. The investments turned China into the world's factory floor and produced eye-popping rates of growth. Over time, China developed a more advanced economy, but the state and companies nevertheless kept on building. The growth rate stayed high, but now the economy was generating wasteful excess that undermined its health. Logan Wright, a partner at the research firm Rhodium Group, estimates that China has 23 million to 26 million unsold apartments. That's enough to house the entire population of Italy. Many of these apartments will never be purchased, Wright conjectures, because they were constructed in towns with declining populations. China's automobile industry, figures Bill Russo, the founder of the consulting firm Automobility in Shanghai, has enough unused factory capacity to make more than 10 million cars, sufficient to supply the entire Japanese car market twice. Beijing boasts about its executive network of high-speed rails, already the world's largest, but the state-owned company that operates it has racked up more than $800 billion in debt and posts substantial losses. The Cato Institute once described China's rail-building bonanza as a high-speed debt trap. The Chinese continue to invest beyond what they can actually absorb, Alicia Garcia Herrero, a senior fellow and specialist in Asian economies at the think tank Bruegel, told me. This is why their model went wrong. As a result of all this unproductive investment, much of it financed by borrowing, China's debt has expanded much faster than its economy. A decade ago, China's total debt was about twice the size of the country's economy. Now it's three times as large. Michael Pettis, a senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, writes that China has among the fastest-growing debt burdens in history. Politics have exacerbated the problem. The Communist Party has trumpeted high growth rates as proof of its legitimacy and competence. So when growth rates have slipped below targets, authorities unleash credit to pump them back up. The International Monetary Fund estimates that China's local governments have amassed $9 trillion in debt in the name of financing infrastructure projects. China's leadership has long known that its investment strategy carried risks. Back in 2007, Wen Jiabao, then China's premier, said, "There are structural problems in China's economy which cause unsteady, unbalanced, uncoordinated, and unsustainable development." The Chinese policymakers knew exactly how to repair these problems. China had to rebalance, as economists say, meaning that it needed to decrease its reliance on investment and foster new engines of growth, especially domestic consumption, which is abysmally low compared to that of other major economies. For that, economists agreed, China would need to liberalize its financial sector and relax the hand of the state on private enterprise. Early in his tenure, Xi seemed to accept these imperatives. In 2013, he signed off on a Communist Party reform blueprint that pledged to give the market a decisive role in the economy. But the reforms never happened. Enacting them would have diminished the power of the state, and thus Xi's own power. China's leader was unwilling to trade political control for economic growth. The more power Xi has commanded, the heavier the state's hand in the economy has become. Xi has relied on state industrial policy to drive innovation, and he has imposed intrusive regulations on important sectors, such as technology and education. As a result, China's private sector is in retreat. 2 years ago, private companies accounted for 55% of the collective value of China's 100 largest publicly traded firms, according to the Peterson Institute for International Economics. Mid-2023, that share fell to 39%. Now rebuilding the private sector's confidence is perhaps the most urgent task facing China's economic policymakers, the Cornell economist Eswar Prasad told me. And on that score, they don't seem fully cognizant of what needs to be done, or maybe they're just not willing to do it. And I think that has some fairly serious repercussions for China's growth. Prasad added that the chances of policymakers correcting course are pretty slim, because they consider private enterprise a, quote, necessary but not really ideal avenue of generating more growth, end quote. At the time when China sorely needed to juice domestic consumption, Xi's draconian pandemic lockdowns delivered a devastating blow to incomes. The China model has cracked under the pressure. So little demand drives the economy that it has slipped into deflation, which, if it persists, could further discourage the investment and consumer spending that the economy needs to revive. The Peking University professor Zhang Dandan recently estimated that the unemployment rate among youth ages 16 to 24 could be close to 50%, more than twice the official figure. Real estate was once a major contributor to economic growth and a store of middle-class wealth. Now investment, sales, and prices in that sector are falling. The largest private developer, Country Garden, is teetering on the brink of default as its Hong Kong-listed shares have lost two-thirds of their value since the beginning of the year. China's economy isn't beyond repair, but fixing it will be costly and painful. The government will have to write off bad debts, close up zombie companies, and introduce sweeping market reforms of a nature that policymakers have so far avoided. Taking these steps would reboot the economy for a new phase of growth, not at the lofty rates of the past, but at a pace that could sustain the country's economic progress. The Chinese government has shown no interest in adopting these reforms, however. Various authorities have issued multiple-point plans to support the economy that amount to little more than administrative tweaks and vague pronouncements. Xi's confidence-inspiring message to the public is essentially, suck it up. We must maintain historic patience and insist on making steady, step-by-step progress, he said in a speech recently published in the Communist Party's top ideological journal. Economists are not anticipating that China will soon collapse into a financial crisis akin to the 2008 Wall Street subprime meltdown, but their outlook on growth has turned somber. Daniel Rosen, a co-founder of Rhodium, says that if China were to make the proper reforms, it could endure a very low growth during the period of adjustment, but then emerge with an annual advances of 3 to 4%. Not bad for an economy its size. But without those reforms, growth will likely slumber at 2 to 3%. Prasad expects that the Chinese economy will grow at 3-4% for the next several years, but that without more market-oriented policies, it will probably not sustain that pace. None of these rates are alarmingly low, but they are probably not high enough to allow China to catch the United States from behind, or even to make it a close competitor in years to come. For Chinese leaders, Prasad told me, the question is whether that is going to be enough to accomplish what they want. Xi Jinping has spent the past decade amassing personal power. Now the yuan has to stop with him. In theory, the economy's troubles should prod him into a rapprochement with the United States to stop economic relations with the West from further deteriorating and keep foreign technology and capital flowing to aid the country's development. But Xi is taking China in a different direction. At the last summit of the BRICS group, BRICS group of developing countries last month, the forum's members, Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, agreed to add six more, including Iran and Saudi Arabia. Xi appeared to envision the BRICS as a counterweight against the West. Global Times, a news outlet run by the Chinese Communist Party, opined that as more like-minded developing countries join BRICS, a stronger collective force will form, emitting a more resounding BRICS voice, driving the world toward good governance. The language suggests that Xi remains undaunted in his quest to remake the world order, despite, or even because of, the economic troubles confronting him at home. The only thing he has changed is the strategy. I think this is the plan. My economy might not be bigger than America's, Bruegel's Garcia Herrero said, but my bloc will be bigger. In other words, if China can't overtake the U.S. on its own, perhaps it could do so in aggregate. But that plan may not work. The economies of the six BRICS members combined are only a bit bigger than the United Kingdom's. The determination to compete with the United States has long been a central component of Xi's economic agenda. In recent years, he has doubled down on industrial policies, including state financial support, specifically devised to put Chinese companies ahead of American rivals in such sectors as artificial intelligence and semiconductors. With a focus on self-sufficiency, he has sought to reduce Chinese vulnerability to U.S. sanctions by substituting homemade alternatives for foreign imports. And his Belt and Road Initiative, a global infrastructure building program, was designed to open avenues of trade and investment for Chinese business beyond the West. The BRICS are even talking about forming their own currency to decrease their dependence on the U.S. dollar. China might not have the economic strength to attain all of these goals. The country remains relatively poor, with a per capita income of $12,700, one-sixth that of the United States. It may not have the resources to support the continued expansion of its military capabilities or to underwrite initiatives meant to bolster its influence abroad. State banks have already scaled back development lending to low-income countries, for example. The slowdown of China's economy may undercut Xi's ideological assault on the world order. For example, China has sought to demonstrate to the global South that democracy and development are not inseparable, and that autocrats can have wealth, international respect, and political power. Those claims are harder to make with a faltering economy. If anything, China's economic troubles suggest that authoritarian regimes cannot both tighten control and sustain economic progress, that ultimately political reform must accompany economic reform. Xi is unlikely to embrace this inconvenient truth. Rather, he will pursue his anti-West agenda with even greater urgency. If he can't point to rapid growth, then he'll have to find some other way to justify his repression to his own people, and a march for global primacy against American imperialists could do the job. Maybe Xi can't or won't make China rich, but at least he'll make China great. For this reason, economic weakness could make China's leaders all the more dangerous, more prone to champion nationalist causes and stumble into foreign adventures, such as a military grab for Taiwan. One can only hope that Xi will look to history and realize that a nation's power can only be projected only as far as its economic strength allows. A Knockout Technique for Achieving More Happiness by Arthur C. Brooks. Mike Tyson is one of the greatest boxers of all time. Over his career, Iron Mike had 50 wins, including 44 knockouts and only 6 losses. Coming from a difficult childhood during which he was surrounded by crime and poverty, he escaped his circumstances through a laser-like focus on his dream of athletic greatness. And he realized that dream by becoming the world heavyweight champion at age 20 in 1986. Despite his success and fame, Tyson was dogged by crises, failed relationships, and legal troubles, including allegations of domestic violence, and nearly 3 years in prison in the 1990s after he was convicted on a charge of rape. He achieved all his ambitions of riches and renown, but a happy life seemed to elude him. This might seem ironic or contradictory to some. To Tyson, however, it was neither. You almost have to give your happiness up to accomplish your goals, he reflected in a 2020 interview. This is what we might call the Tyson paradox. Building a good life requires us to have goals that keep us focused, enthusiastic, and out of trouble. But actually attaining those goals might not give us the payoff we imagined, and could in fact bring us misery. Although most of us will never see the highs and lows that Mike Tyson experienced, we can all easily fall into our own version of the same trap. To have an ambitious goal in life is a good thing, as psychologists since the 1970s have shown. It provides structure and meaning and leads to higher satisfaction, as long as you make progress toward your goal. As a result, the notion of attaining this goal should also have a positive effect, as the psychologist Bettina S. Weiss writes, and has gone largely unquestioned. Yet most of us think of many little counterexamples of our own. If you have ever tried to lose weight and succeeded, you know the satisfaction that comes from seeing the scale fall. It makes the sacrifice in what you eat feel worthwhile. But after that, what's the reward for hitting your target weight? Not eating what you love ever again, just to keep it there? The sacrifice no longer delivers that sweet progress. It devolves into avoiding the chagrin of seeing the scale go back up. This effect may help explain why one review of diet research found that roughly 35% of dieters seem to develop pathological dieting behaviors, and 20 to 25% of those people ended up with partial or full eating disorders. The problem behind the Tyson paradox is called the arrival fallacy, the assumption that once we hit a goal or reach a destination, the bliss we get will last. This is impossible because of our evolved inability to maintain any strong emotional state. We move back to our emotional equilibrium quickly, a tendency called homeostasis, to be ready to process whatever new circumstances we face. The problem is less that we can't get no satisfaction per the Rolling Stones, and the more that we can't keep no satisfaction. Researchers have demonstrated the arrival fallacy in various creative ways. In the past, I have written about how athletes encounter this goal attainment problem. In a field of endeavor that is closer to my professorial heart, my colleague Dan Gilbert and several co-authors surveyed young university professors on how happy they expected to be if they attend tenure, a huge goal for every aspiring academic, compared with how happy they actually were when they got it. The professors systematically overestimated their happiness by about 13%. On the bright side, those denied tenure are 27% less unhappy than they expected to be. You might conclude that the solution to the Tyson paradox is to give up on your life goals. They're all anticipation and no payoff, right? Not quite. There is a way to defeat the paradox. It just requires setting the right type of goals. A clue as to how comes from research on job satisfaction published in a 2005 issue of the Journal of Applied Psychology. Scholars collected data on hundreds of individuals who were asked whether their professional goals were extrinsic, involving material rewards such as pay and prestige, or intrinsic, intangibles such as fun and enjoyment, especially when shared with other people. The people who concentrated on intrinsic professional goals were significantly more satisfied with their jobs than those who didn't. This finding is consistent with other research showing that, in general, relationship goals bring greater well-being than achievement goals. People who have had an ambition to foster deeper friendships, a better marriage, and closer connections with their children and their parents tend to be happier than people working for worldly rewards. Even within achievement goals themselves, we can see a reinforcing pattern. Psychologists showed in 2017 that there are two kinds of achievement: mastery, excelling at your job, and performance, obtaining objective results such as earning more money than others. Performance goals brought happiness only when participants were compared favorably with others. This suggests that in the times when inevitably such favorable comparisons are not available, the goals will make you unhappy. In contrast, mastery goals can raise your satisfaction regardless of comparison with others. In short, the goals most likely to defeat the Tyson paradox are social and relational, about giving and getting love. Achievement goals are more likely to lead to the arrival fallacy, especially if they involve peer juxtaposition. This is, of course, at odds with most self-fulfillment literature, which promises to teach you how to be rich and powerful. If you are a hard-charging striver, all of this might make you feel uncomfortable about your decisions, as though I'm saying something absurd like, trying to be 5% richer than your neighbor might not be a good reason to neglect your kids. If this is the case and you feel that uneasiness, that may be because you are a success addict, someone who has put being special before being happy. I have seen this in hundreds of cases in my research. I strongly suspect that this was true of Iron Mike himself, and that is what he means in saying that your goals can be at odds with your well-being. Greater awareness of this conflict can enable you to adjust priorities in life. This is probably the most important insight we can all use to defeat the Tyson paradox. Having goals in life is human and healthy. To provide direction and purpose, a journey requires a destination. But the journey, not the destination, is what gives us the satisfaction and meaning we truly need. We've run out of time for today's episode of The Atlantic. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The Atlantic is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.